This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, State Senator Tanya Shoemaker discusses an upcoming summit on preventing sexual assault on college campuses and the ongoing debate over road funding in Michigan. But first, racial equality is often framed as an issue of fairness or social justice. But a new report, funded by the W.K. Kellogg Foundation and prepared by the Altarum Institute, says that racial equity is also good for business. Allie Webb is director of Michigan programs for the Kellogg Foundation. Thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure, Gordon.
Give us the simple case, as they say, the elevator speech that you might make to a business owner as to why a business owner or a manager of a business in Michigan should be concerned about racial equality.
It's really common sense. So if you think about, the first report we did actually looked at the business case for racial equity in the United States. And the numbers are, they're kind of startling. So if people of color in the United States had the same average income of white residents, the U.S. earnings would increase by 12%. So you might say, well, why does that matter? Because that means corporate profits would increase by $180 billion. That's with a B. So simply by having equity across earning, you would increase corporate profits by $180 billion. And that's true in Michigan as well.
Part of the argument here then is that this is a consumer-driven economy. If the economy is going to get better, people have to spend money. If they're going to spend money, they have to have it to begin with.
Exactly. And people ought not to be, and we know this is true in gender as well as in race, that there are structural barriers to people being able to earn at equal amounts as other people by no virtue of a skill. We're not talking about an unskilled person versus a skilled person. This is people of equal skills. It's just widely proven that people of color in particular, and we know this from about women as well, are paid less than their white counterparts.
Well, there's a section in the report about something called the Race for Results Index. Tell us a little bit about this and how Michigan stacks up.
So the Race for Results Index assembles 12 different measures of success for children, and then creates a single score between 0 and 1,000 for each racial or ethnic group in a state. And so the higher the score, the greater the likelihood that that group is succeeding. So the individual measures include things like, is a baby born at a healthy birth weight? Does a child have an opportunity to participate in preschool? What are your graduation rates? How many people are living at or below the poverty level? So remember, it's a 1,000-point score. So if you're a white child in Michigan, your score is 688. For Latino children, it's 411. For American Indian children, it's 501. And for African American children, it's 244 out of 1,000. So only two states, Mississippi and Wisconsin, have lower scores for African American children.
You've mentioned a couple times structural barriers. How tangible are these? What can we say are the structural barriers that get in the way of the African American family having their children closer to 700 on that index as opposed to more around 240?
Yeah, and we'd like all children to be at 1,000, white children included. Obviously, our mission is about all children thriving. Children of color in Michigan are likely to live in areas of concentrated poverty, with low-performing schools, with additional health risks, either a lack of adequate access to high-quality health care. They're just compounding factors when you're living in poverty that surround you. And, the numbers are just really, really interesting. So 70% of children of color are at risk of poor outcomes compared to 48% of white children. So I in Michigan, I'm unwilling to accept that 48% of white children in Michigan today are likely to have poor educational outcomes. That's not acceptable. But 70% of children of color, and this is age group 0 to 3, is absolutely unacceptable.
So do we have a big link then that we could go through with all of these issues? Education, poverty, health. We haven't even touched on incarceration yet. Are these all just sort of links in what we might call a very bad chain in this case?
Oh, that's a great analogy. It's a really bad chain of events for children, and it's a downward spiral. So the question is, do we know enough as a state to break this cycle or break this chain of bad outcomes? And the answer to that is absolutely. We actually know how to educate children in Michigan. We know how to provide health care. The question that we ponder here and with our partners is, if we know how to do this, what is then stopping us as a state from saying every child needs to get high-quality early education experience? What is stopping us from saying every child needs to have be born at a healthy birth weight? I mean, if you're an African-American woman in Michigan, your child is likely not to be born at a healthy birth weight. And that's not because of any fault of your own. It has to do with what kind of prenatal care are you getting? And what is your access to health care? Is your access, the emergency room? So there are structural barriers that we've created through a long legacy of racial inequality in the country that we just simply must become aware of, and we must decide we're going to face.
You know, the issue of premature births, of infant mortality, that's been studied pretty closely here in Kalamazoo, where there's been a big racial disparity. And some of the people I've talked to have said, even when you account for income, there is still a racial gap. In other words, if you have an African-American woman and a white woman who are making about the same amount, maybe both in professional jobs, it is still more likely that the African-American woman will either lose her child or will have a baby at a very low birth weight or will have problems. So I guess that leads to the question of, is it beyond simple economics? Are there other things out there that we have to tackle if we're going to get at just that issue, much less the larger issues that are detailed in this report?
Oh, I think that's absolutely true. Some of these factors are not controlled by income. They're controlled by other factors like unequal access to knowledge or unequal access to information or services. So then the question I'd ask in Kalamazoo, so if that's the case, what is it that African-American moms aren't getting that their white counterparts are? And then fix that. You know, we want all babies to be born at a healthy birth weight. Because if you're not born at a healthy birth weight, the cost to the rest of us simply escalates.
Are there some programs out there in Michigan or perhaps in other states which are getting at some of these issues and are showing some success?
Oh, yeah. I mean, as I said, we actually know how to fix these problems. We have our Great Start Readiness Program here in the state of Michigan that the governor and the legislature have recently in the last 2 years, and I think again this year, are putting more money into. And we know from that program, which has been around long enough that a cohort of children have graduated from high school, that if your child was enrolled in the Great Start Readiness Program, it's an income related program, so you have to be low income in order to participate. 60% of the children who participated in Great Start Readiness graduated high school. Just take a wild guess of the kids in the same income bracket who didn't have access to Great Start Readiness. 37% of those children graduated from high school. Now, math was not my best subject in school, but I can sure tell that I am more interested in 60% of children graduating high school than I am in 37%.
High-quality preschool is an issue where business leaders have been on board and have been supportive of the idea that Michigan needs more high-quality preschool.
Yeah, exactly.
So are there other issues where perhaps business leaders have not been as vocal or have not gotten involved in the issue, and those are still lagging so that they haven't gotten the attention that, that the Great Start Readiness Program has, for example?
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right. The business community, business leaders of Michigan as a group, and well as just individual business leaders, as well as law enforcement and retired military, all made the case in Michigan that we had to fund early child care, particularly for four-year-olds, to meet the need. You know, we have to have enough funding to meet the need. Right now we have not enough funding. We're just about getting to the point where every child who's eligible has access to a slot. What we don't have in every community, particularly under-resourced communities, is enough slots. So what we need to figure out is how to encourage business startups. How do we make providing high-quality childcare a attractive business proposition for a young entrepreneur in a city in Michigan where there aren't enough slots? You know, the biggest challenge, I think, around the business community really is the question of wages and permanent work. So are we, as a state, as a business community, do we have a line of sight where we can pay people who work full-time a wage that will allow them to support their families? And that's a conversation we're going to continue to have, because this governor and this legislature really is all about jobs and job creation. And we want to make sure that the jobs that are created are available to Michiganders and that they pay a wage that you can support a family on. And that's something where the business community, they have other pressures, but we've got to keep having that conversation.
As the report notes, Michigan spends more on corrections than most other states. And, of course, many of the, if you go by the percentage of people incarcerated, more likely to be people of color in many cases. But there is a pilot program in Kalamazoo and Pontiac which is at least addressing what to do with prisoners when they reenter society. Can you tell us a little bit about what that is doing, and is it showing some promise?
Yeah. There have been a couple of programs. The one that I'm most familiar with is the Michigan Prisoner Reentry Program. It has really shown that if you prepare inmates for their reentry, so you work with their families, you work with the inmates, you make sure that are about to be released, you make sure they have the social supports as well as the financial supports they have, and that they have access to employment, recidivism really goes down dramatically. And I don't have the statistics at my fingertips, but I know that it's remarkable. And so, you know, we've got to figure out how to prepare returning citizens for the world that they're going to encounter. And the Department of Corrections in the state of Michigan really has shown they know how to do that. Now we just have to scale it up, which for some reason seems to be a bigger challenge than doing a successful pilot.
So if the business owner, the CEO, the guy who has the CEO's ear, hears this interview or reads the study and says, you know, this makes a lot of sense, what's the next step? What should the business community in Michigan be doing to try and achieve the goals that you've spelled out?
Well, let me talk about what a lot of them already are doing. What we've had in Michigan, and this is a national challenge as well, is a disconnect between our workforce training capacity, be it at a community college or a four-year university or a trade school or some certificate program, being connected to an actual employer's needs. And so we're finding that when we can connect, and I don't mean philanthropy, I mean in general, when we can get business at the table to tell us what they need in an employee, we can get the people who are providing the training at the table to say, okay, well, we can train to that. We can then bring in people who are interested in working. It's it's strange just to think that the link between workforce training and employers is broken. But we know when we can connect that link, that we can get people into work and they stay in work. And you know, one of the biggest costs that employers find is training. So it makes really good business sense for businesses to want to retain their workers. They have to come in with the right skills. You then have to commit to helping your employees' skills grow so that they stay and prosper in your organization. So I would encourage employers to look around to see what kind of relationships they can forge with the trainers, the people who are providing workforce, who are providing their raw talent to their business. And they're going to find willing partners, be it in education or in other workforce training programs.
Allie Webb, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
Allie Webb is Director of Michigan Programs for the Kellogg Foundation. You can find a link to the study about why there is a business case for racial equity in Michigan at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Michigan's First Lady, Sue Snyder, is hosting a summit next week in Lansing on preventing sexual assault on college campuses. Among the co-hosts is State Senator Tanya Shootmaker of Lawton. The Republican represents Van Buren, Allegan, and part of Kent County in the Michigan Senate. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Also joined today by Kalamazoo Gazette reporter Emily Monticelli.
Thanks for having me.
Emily, first question for Senator Shootmaker.
Can you tell us a little bit about the summit and how you got involved?
Well, I was honored to have been asked by the First Lady. She was talking, I believe the story is, that she was talking with a friend whose daughter had been sexually assaulted on campus. She also has a daughter going off or is a freshman at a college this year, and so she had concerns. And then I, too, also have a daughter that will be going off to college in about a year. I have a son at college right now. And so we have about 1 in 5 women that are sexually assaulted on campus. And out of that 1 in 5, only about 12% actually report it. So we have to do something to end it. So she felt that this was an important initiative to take up as First Lady. And so she decided to get all the parties together, law enforcement, and also all 15 public universities, and also the independent colleges as well, to get together and talk about how we can do better at preventing and ending sexual assault.
Is the reporting of it mostly on the victim? Is it the victim who is not coming forward right now and saying something? And is that where you need to start in making sure that someone feels okay in coming forward and reporting if something's happened to them?
You know, that's one of the problems, is to make sure that we have a culture where victims are taken seriously, where they feel comfortable in order to report, and so that we have better reporting statistics. But the other thing is also to law enforcement, how they behave towards the victim, to make sure that the victim feels comfortable. So the problem's not just always, you know, that the victim doesn't feel comfortable. It's also, you know, in terms of protocol and procedures. In talking to all 15 public universities, we had a luncheon where there was no press, and so we kind of had a frank discussion. And what was kind of telling is that every public university does something different in regards to this. There's no kind of uniformity of best practices. Now, our universities do a pretty good job currently addressing this, but can we always improve and do better? You know, I as a person certainly can. And so therefore, I think it's important to have policies and procedures and protocols that are kind of uniform in terms of what are the best practices out there.
If all 15 public universities are doing something different, is it possible to take a look and figure out who amongst those 15 is doing the best job and then make those policies more uniform?
I definitely think that should be the number one job and goal out of the summit, is to do that.
As a state lawmaker, are there things that you definitely want to hear certain people that you want to hear from, I guess? And is there certain information you're trying to get at? And do you see a role down the road for the state legislature to enact something that perhaps puts some reporting requirements or some other mandates in?
Right. Definitely. By no means am I the expert in this. And so we'll be hearing from law enforcement. We'll be hearing from experts. We'll be hearing, you know, from other states. Also, the universities will be present in terms of coming up with procedures and solutions to end this. And also, the First Lady has a website that I wanted to get out on there, which is www.ncampussexualassault.com. And so if anyone is very interested, any of your listeners, they can certainly turn to that as well.
Emily?
I understand that the summit kicks off a larger campaign. And so what else is there to go along with the summit in this overall campaign?
Well, you know, we will be having the summit and then kind of taking the information that we gain out there along with, you know, the information that the universities have already given us and kind of coming up with, you know, like a plan in order to address this, because one sexual assault is one too many.
As you noted, there's a lot more than that. How confident are people in the numbers that we get? I mean, you know, do we get a full picture in the numbers that we hear, or is it possible that the numbers we do hear are maybe below, you know, not giving us the full picture?
Right. And, you know, I said that, you know, one in five women, yeah, it's estimated, and that's just an estimate. And so out of that, 12% really are the ones that report. So, you know, I think you bring up a very good point in terms of getting better numbers and statistics. And you can't do that unless you kind of change, you know, the stigma and the outlook out there for women coming forward to say that, you know, they were sexually assaulted. You know, we also have, you know, there's date rape drugs out there. So hopefully, you know, identifying, you know, better methods is to having women, you know, at least knowledge is power. And so if you're out at the bar, you know, making sure that your drink is not tampered with, you know, raising awareness for kind of looking out for yourself and looking out for your friends as well.
Let me move on to a couple of other issues, okay, which are before the legislature. Proposal 1, which was supposed to be the solution to road funding in Michigan, was rejected overwhelmingly by voters. So as a state lawmaker right now, what do you want to do, or what do you think are ideas that should be considered for funding roads?
Well, certainly that funding roads plays into the budget. What we've done is we passed out the budgets, which are now in. Actually, the conference committees have met, and so we're on track to do the budget. We're actually going to put in this year's budget the same amount of money that would have been put in for this calendar year if Proposal 1 had passed. So we've reprioritized a number of things, such as we've severely cut out film tax credits, which I think a lot of people are like, you know, we can't fund our roads, but we're funding film tax credits. We have done a number of other things. Higher ed saw a slight decrease from the increase that they got. They were getting a 2% increase pre-Proposal 1 going down. Now they're getting a 1.5% increase, so that we do have money to reprioritize and put towards our roads for this year. Now you bring up, what are we going to do in the long term? Because the estimates are that you need $1.5 billion each and every year for the next 20 years, and that's just to maintain our roads. So you do need a long-term funding solution to do that, because you can't, you know, every year be put in the situation of how do you come up with that. And so we came up with $400 million, which is probably the appropriate number, because you don't want to put too much money too fast into it, because then that isn't probably a wise use. But you do need to come up with about $1.5 billion. And just to put that into context, our state general fund is somewhere in the neighborhood of $9.7-$9.8 billion. So $1.5 billion is a huge chunk to come out of our general fund budget.
10%,
a little bit more. And so we are going to have to probably look at, so we as a Senate caucus, and I think the House is going to come up with their plan. I think they did release a plan, which was built upon growth. Now, I don't necessarily agree that, you know, while hopefully the economy will continue to increase, I don't think that's necessarily a long-term solution, is to hope everything upon a growth of an economy, certainly.
At some point, there's going to be a downturn. There's a cyclical,
most likely,
a cyclical nature to the economy.
So you probably do need to look at new revenues or, you know, to cut. I, for one, actually was one of the ones that voted on a gas tax pre-proposal one being passed by the legislature. My problem with not voting for proposal one was that it had a lot of other stuff. And as I heard other people out there of various reasons why they voted against proposal one, it wasn't so much that they don't feel like our roads need to be fixed or they're not willing to pay for it, is that there was other stuff in proposal one that they didn't like. And so, you know, we'll get together. Certainly the key number is to come out with 20, 56, and one. 20 senators need to vote on something. We got 20 votes for a gas tax before, and then the House rejected that, and that's how we came up with proposal one. And then you need 56 state representatives and one governor to all agree to that. So certainly I think the Senate is going to sit down. We're going to look at our budget. We're going to get rid of all the stuff people say is fat, is a waste of government. And then once we do that, then we're going to look at, you know, how we go about increasing revenue in terms of paving our roads. I personally, I'm a fiscal conservative, but I do believe a core function of government is our roads and infrastructure.
I'm wondering, though, when you go from a 2% increase for the higher education budget down to 1.5%, which I think if we were talking right now to John Dunn or anybody at the administration building, they would tell you that's not going to cover increased costs. How much fat is really left in that budget if you're making cuts like that in order to put the money that you're going to put into roads?
You know, they'll have to make that determination. They also, you know, state funding of a higher education, a university's budget is roughly about 22%, some universities more, some universities less. So they make up that difference in tuition. You know, as I hear parents talk about tuition, it's never going down and, you know, it's only going up. And, you know, it's unfortunate because with the increase in the Medicaid budget over the last 25, 30 years, that has really cut into the higher education budget. When you and I went to college, you know, the state funded about 75% of a college education. Now it's directly opposite that. So, you know, that will result, if we don't do something about our roads, is you know, pretty much privatizing higher education. That's not something I want for Michigan, but, you know, there are some people out there that do want that. I personally think that the state has a responsibility and I think it's right to, you know, further somebody's education if we want a talented and educated workforce going into the future. And, you know, that's diversified and on the cutting edge of the states.
Do you agree that there has to be some sort of an increase in revenue then? Which is what the governor has said, that you're not going to be able to do this in the existing budget. And if so, it's apparently not going to be the sales tax because the voters have said no. And it doesn't seem as though lawmakers want to go back to the ballot. So what's left? Is it, you know, for instance, gas tax? Is it vehicle registration fees?
I would say that's it. Gas tax and vehicle registration fees. I'm open to looking at anything. You know, there's no perfect solution out there. Certainly with the gas tax, you have more electric vehicles that eventually will be obsolete. At the very least, what the legislature should have done probably 10 years ago is to equate the gas tax to the rate of inflation so that there was an inflationary component in there, because one of the things that is missing is that the gas tax never kept up with the rate of inflation. So at the very least, you should tag it to keeping up with the rate of inflation, which hasn't been done. They should have done it back in 97 and they didn't.
State Senator Tanya Shoemaker, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Tanya Shoemaker is a Republican from Lawton. Her Senate district includes Van Buren, Allegan, and part of Kent County. And we also want to thank Kalamazoo Gazette reporter Emily Monticelli.
Thank you.
Links with more information, longer versions of interviews, and past programs can always be found at wmuk.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.